You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Few mainstream scientists today would disagree that human activity is contributing to global warming or that climate change holds serious consequences for life on our planet, from rising sea levels to more extreme weather events like droughts or floods to shifts in growing seasons as regional climates change. So on this Earth Day 2005, we're going to take a look at the realities of climate change. We'll talk with a reporter who traveled to Alaska and Greenland to see firsthand the effects of warming in places that are hardest hit. We're also going to talk with a climate scientist whose graph depicting changes in the Earth's temperature has come to symbolize climate change and has come under attack by climate skeptics. How do these scientists respond to a well-financed campaign aimed to discredit their work? We'll hear about a new website that debunks the debunkers. And if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can head over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more information. Let me introduce my guests. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer and political correspondent for The New Yorker here in New York. She joins us today in our Science Friday studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Michael Mann is a professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Next fall, he'll be joining the Meteorology Department at Penn State University, where he'll also be directing the Penn State Earth Science System Science Center. He joins us today from his office in Charlottesville. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here with you.
Thank you. Elizabeth, you traveled to Alaska. We keep hearing about there's incredible evidence of global warming up there. What did you see?
Well, I went to a town called Shishmaref, which is on an island that's basically disappearing. And the reason it's disappearing is because the sea ice now freezes later, and the storms that come up in the fall used to be sort of tamped down by this layer of ice on the water, and now there's no ice until later in the season. And so every year, every other year, the fall storms come through and basically wash away part of this tiny island. And recently they all decided that they were going to have to move.
Yeah. We've seen pictures for the last few winters of the sea ice missing from the Arctic regions where there used to be trouble for ships to go through, and now it's almost clear during the Arctic summertime.
Well, melting sea ice, the perennial sea ice cover in the Arctic has shrunken quite dramatically, and that is a pretty serious, has a lot of consequences, not just that it's melting now, but every bit that melts, the water absorbs more heat. So it's a climate feedback. It's something that takes a little change to the climate and basically nudges it into a much larger change.
Instead of having that ice there that used to reflect the sunlight, now there's no ice there, so it just feeds back, the heat feeds back on itself.
Exactly, and it's quite significant.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mann, your hockey stick graph has come to symbolize current scientific thinking on climate change. Can you describe it for us and what
Sure.
it shows?
Sure. The term hockey stick was actually coined by a colleague of mine, Dr. Jerry Malman, who was the former head of NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in Princeton. And this term was used to describe the pattern common to various estimates of the changes in the average temperature of the Northern Hemisphere in past centuries, based either on statistical reconstructions of long-term temperature changes using so-called proxy data, such as tree rings, corals, ice cores, and lake sediments, or using computer simulations based on climate models, driving them with changes in the natural and human or anthropogenic factors that govern the climate. And the pattern common to these estimates resembles a hockey stick in that it is characterized by a long-term cooling trend from what we might term the medieval warm period, broadly speaking, the 10th through 14th centuries, through the so-called Little Ice Age, broadly speaking, the 15th through 19th centuries. But that cooling trend is followed by a rapid warming during the 20th century that culminates in anomalous late 20th century warmth and forms the so-called blade of the hockey stick.
So it's where the blade meets the stick, that
Absolutely.
Sharp increase in the global temperatures. Your graph spans 1,000 years. Can you put the last 100 years or so, or the recent warming trend into perspective?
Yes. The warming that we've seen during the 20th century is outside of the range of the uncertainties in what we estimate temperatures have been over the past 1,000, or now we believe even 2,000 years. So even taking into account the fact that our estimates are fairly uncertain. After all, we're not making use of thermometer measurements 500 years ago, but these indirect indicators like tree rings and corals. But even taking into account those estimates, which we can estimate, the uncertainties, the late 20th century warmth is indeed anomalous in this very long-term context.
Elizabeth, you interviewed many scientists, and I noticed that you were struck with how certain they are of global warming and how there seems to be such a disconnect with the public about it.
Yeah, that is a very, very good point, and it's a very striking thing when you talk to scientists. And I think one thing that's important to keep in mind with about global warming is it's based on very, very simple principles of physics, as one climatologist put it to me, physics 101. If you put more CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, physics says you're going to raise the temperature of the Earth. And in fact, now we see, as Professor Mann pointed out, that we have raised the temperature of the Earth. So you have a theory, and then you have confirmation of it. And most scientists consider that to be, you know, that's science. You have a theory, you confirm it, that's that. And so the fact that we're still sort of arguing in the political discourse has very little to do with the actual scientific discourse.
But you said that the scientists were shocked themselves at how little what they're saying is leaking into the bubble.
Well, and I think that that's a very disturbing fact about political discourse.
Are they frightened by the kind of global warming they're seeing? Is it being irreversible and we don't know where it's heading?
I think that many people, and especially people who work in the Arctic, and they talk about the Arctic going into a new state, a state that hasn't occurred since humans have been on the planet. And that is a pretty frightening, and I think people are pretty alarmed in the scientific community.
Dr. Mann, among scientists, is there any reasonable doubt that we humans are having this effect on the climate?
Well, if you had asked me that question about 10 years ago, when I was still in graduate school, I would have said, yes, the proposition was one that is likely, but with some degree of uncertainty. That uncertainty has diminished quite a bit over the past 10 years or so, as we have seen climate change progress, as the computer models that we use to study the climate have become more sophisticated, and as our knowledge has increased. And so I think it's fair to say there are very few legitimate scientists within the community who would dispute that humans are indeed having an influence on 20th century climate.
So where do you think the dispute, who are these scientists who don't agree with you?
Well, actually, as Elizabeth nicely explains in a Q&A that I read of hers on the New Yorker website, there has been a very well-financed disinformation campaign that's designed to convince people that there is still disagreement about the science supporting the proposition that humans are influencing the climate, when in fact there really is quite broad agreement. That's not to say that there aren't still uncertainties in some areas of the science. However, there is a great deal of consensus with regard to the conclusion that the anomalous warming of the globe and changes in many other attributes of the climate are due to anthropogenic influences.
So how do you respond to skeptics? And in particular, Michael Crichton's new book takes your hockey stick as the focal point of the book and just tries to trash the whole thing.
Well, we actually, on realclimate.org, a website that a number of colleagues of mine and I are involved with, which I think we might get to talking about later, we actually have addressed some of the disinformation that's put out by Crichton's book in some detail. I think it's probably fair to say that that his criticisms are really unfounded and reflect a fairly poor understanding of the science, and in some cases a fairly dramatic misrepresentation of what the science actually has to offer.
Speaking of the science, Elizabeth Culbert, when you were in Greenland, we hear about Antarctica, we hear about Alaska, but the ice in Greenland, you say, is melting pretty quickly also.
Well, yeah, I was up on the ice sheet with some scientists who are taking measurements every summer, and there are also satellite measurements being taken all the time. And the big question mark that hangs over Greenland, and also Antarctica, but many people feel that Greenland could start to melt at an earlier stage than Antarctica, is whether we're setting in motion an irreversible loss of the Greenland ice sheet, and the Greenland ice sheet has enough water to raise global sea levels by 23 feet. So that's a very, very important question mark that hangs over this. And even if we have not, if we are not setting it in motion right now, then the question arises, at what point, how much sort of leeway do we have right now as we continue to add greenhouse gases into the atmosphere? And increasingly, scientists are saying, you know, not that much, and we better take account of that.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mann, if we were to stop now, would we still be watching these ice caps melt for some period of time and an inevitable rise in ocean levels?
Yeah, indeed. There's something that we in the research community refer to as the commitment to warming. And what that has to do with is the fact that there's a fairly large amount of inertia in the climate system, in particular because of the slow time scales on which the ocean rises in response to an imposed warming, and the fairly long time scales on which large ice sheets respond. So if we were to stop increasing CO2 concentrations right now and keep them at their current level, we would still see warming of surface temperatures for nearly a century, perhaps. We would see, because of the sort of longer time scales involved in the deep ocean, the diffusion of heat down into the deep ocean, it would take a number of centuries for that warming to actually penetrate into the deep ocean. And that has implications for sea level rise, because sea levels rise as ocean water warms and expands. Mm-hmm. And since there are a number of centuries that it would take for the entire ocean to warm up in response to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations that have already occurred, sea level will continue to rise for centuries.
Mm-hmm. So this is something we're going to have to just learn how to live with now. This is an accepted fact, Elizabeth, that we have to get ready for sea levels to rise.
Well, there's two questions. There is, as Professor Mann just said, there's a lot of warming in the system already that will take many decades, centuries to play itself out. But the question that is before us all now as a society is how much, as he said, mm-hmm. a commitment to warming. What kind of a commitment do we want to make here? And as CO2 levels continue to rise, they give us a larger and larger commitment. And that's not for ourselves, but that's for our kids and for our grandkids.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk lots more about global warming and new evidence of it in the Antarctic Peninsula, that little piece that points toward South America, some new research on how fast it's happening there. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about climate change. You know, most of the world's fresh water is locked up in Antarctica in the form of ice sheets, glaciers, ice shelves. Antarctica is also warming faster than many other places on the planet, and that means lots of melting ice, lots of fresh water going into the oceans. And if you need new evidence for global warming, a study published in this week's journal Science provides dramatic pictures. You can go look at them yourselves. Researchers from the British Antarctic Survey and the U.S. Geological Survey studied photographs of more than 200 glaciers in the Antarctic Peninsula, which juts out of the continent towards South America. And they found that while 50 years ago these glaciers were growing, since then almost all of them have been shrinking. And over the past 5 years, they've been shrinking at a dramatic rate, faster than any other observed time. Joining me now to talk about glacial melting in Antarctica is David Vaughan, a glaciologist and principal investigator of the Program on Glacial Retreat in Antarctica and the Glaciation of the Earth System at the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, the UK. He joins us from there. Good evening and welcome to the program, Dr. Vaughan.
Good evening, Ira.
I thank you for being with us. Other studies have documented worldwide the glacial melting. What's different about your study?
Well, we've done it in Antarctica, of course. We've done it in an area of Antarctica that seems to be warming much faster than the other areas of Antarctica. And we've managed to get 50 years of data. Most of the data that we're looking at comes from early expedition reports and aerial photographs that you mentioned that were taken when people were originally mapping this area. So we've gone quite a long way back in time. We've looked at a lot of glaciers.
Mm-hmm. And is it going faster than was expected?
I think it is, yes. Certainly, as you rightly pointed out, back in the 1950s, many of these glaciers seemed to be advancing. Overall, the trend seemed to be for advancing. But in since then, we've seen a wave sweep down the Antarctic Peninsula, And now most of the glaciers are going into retreat. That wave of retreat has started to sweep down the peninsula.
There is a small number of them that are advancing. Can you understand why they might be advancing while the others are all retreating?
Yeah, that's really very, very interesting. This is a class of glaciers, a type of glacier that really has been said to be very unpredictable. And when people have looked at them individually or maybe in just two or threes, it's been very hard to see why particular glaciers were responding in particular ways. So really, the fact that we've looked at so many glaciers means that the signal is dropping out statistically and we can start to see the patterns. Mm-hmm. But there is some variability in how these glaciers respond. And if we'd actually started 20 years ago just looking at just a handful and called those our benchmark glaciers, we might have got completely the wrong end of the stick, the wrong story.
Yeah. How do we know that this is just not some variable part of a cooling and a warming Earth's natural cycle here?
That's a good point. Certainly from this data, we don't know the answer to that. And this could be, you know, the tail end of a 100-year cycle, a century-long cycle. But we do know from other evidence that ice shelves around the Antarctic Peninsula have been retreating, and we've been to some areas of seabed where they used to be covered by ice shelves, and we can see that some of those ice shelves that have only retreated in the last 10 years were in existence for at least 2,000 years and possibly as long as 10,000 years. So we actually believe that the temperature hasn't got to current levels for at least 2,000 years, which is quite a long time, I think.
Why do you think this is this area in Antarctica is warming so much faster than other parts of the world?
Yeah, that's another key point. There are several areas that seem to be warming very fast, and they're all in high latitudes. Northern Alaska and the Bering Sea is warming very similar rates. One of the reasons is that this is on the edge of the Antarctic continent and is underneath weather systems, which appear to have migrated south a little bit in the last few years. And as those weather systems have migrated south, it's bringing a lot more northerly air into the area, northerly winds bringing warm air down from the Pacific Ocean. And it's quite possible that minor shift in the weather systems, the weather patterns, has actually caused quite a strong change in the temperature.
Is this melting in the peninsula, which is, you know, the little piece that's not really in the mainland, is it indicative of what is happening in the large giant ice sheets in the central part of Antarctica?
Flatly no, it isn't. There are other processes that probably dominate the change in the rest of Antarctica. In the West Antarctic ice sheet, which lots of people have talked about as being potentially unstable, we can see changes, and we really need to work out what's going on in that area and whether those changes are going to accelerate in future. That's a retreat. But in the East Antarctic ice sheet, we don't have good records at the moment, but one process that might be dominant, and it's a very large area, is that increasing snowfall may be starting to lock up more water in the ice sheet. We don't have any strong evidence for this at the moment, but it's something that seems to drop out of the climate models, that the ice sheet might thicken, perhaps only by a few centimeters per year, but that might be enough because it's such a large area to have a slightly moderating effect on sea level rise.
And one last question. Is there any relationship between the north part, the melting that we're seeing in Greenland, and what's going on in the southern hemisphere?
Well, there's no direct connection, I don't think, but it's entirely possible that some of the mechanisms that we see that control the climate around the Antarctic and in the Arctic are similar, and feedbacks between sea ice and climate, perhaps, are something that might be common to both areas.
One final question. We have skeptics, we have a minority of skeptics in the U.S. here about global warming. There don't seem to be that many skeptics in Great Britain. Do you have any idea why that might be?
No. One of the ways that I tend to personally try and talk to people about science and climate change is really just to get them to accept the facts, the scientific facts as they stand, without prejudging how people would react and what society as a whole, democracy as a whole, should decide to do about it. So I stand fairly neutral on those questions whilst trying to tell people about what I see as the facts of climate change.
Is that old legal phrase, res ipsa locator, the object speaks for itself.
Right.
So it seems to be quite obvious.
And if you try and prejudge things, then people become swayed by your own personal feelings rather than being able to accept things as they stand.
Dr. Vaughan, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today, for staying up late.
Thanks very much.
David Vaughan is a glaciologist and principal investigator of the Program on Glacial Retreat in Antarctica and Deglaciation of the Earth System at the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, UK. My other guest, Dr. Michael Mann, professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Elizabeth Colbert, political correspondent for The New Yorker in New York City. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Patrick in North Carolina. Hi, Patrick.
Hello. How are you all doing?
Hi there.
I say we have so many different problems. Our universities have split the scientific disciplines into narrow fields, applied sciences to make money, and, of course, pure sciences are to further knowledge, and we need a little more emphasis on the pure science. Years ago, we were taught that the Earth's heat comes from residual heat from the formation of the Earth or nuclear energy, and I never did believe it.
Why don't you believe that?
Well, just my other elementary science makes me believe that the Earth is more like a generator or a dynamo rotating in a magnetic field with a dead short represented by the huge currents in the ocean and in the atmosphere, ionosphere.
So where does the whole idea of global warming fit in with your thinking on this?
Okay, I think the Earth is a geomagnetic electric system that maintains its balance as a reflection of the activity in the nuclear furnaces of the sun. It's obviously been in equilibrium for millions of years, making slight shifts and changes, and that's where we need to get the solar physicist online with the Earth physicist.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. 1-800-989-8255. Dr. Mann, you're listening to Dr. Vaughan over there in Great Britain talking about his research. It seems to back up a lot of things we were talking about before.
Well, it's one in a number of pieces of evidence that collectively really do demonstrate that there are fairly dramatic changes occurring in the climate system as we enter into the 21st century that seem, from a variety of evidence, to be unprecedented on a very long time scale. Could I respond to the caller? because there are the caller's comment reflects the fact that there is a fair amount of confusion in the public at large with regard to the science of climate change. And some of that is just due to the complexity of the subject, but some of that is due to the fact that there is quite a bit of disinformation that's been put out there by certain groups. So when we the idea of the molten solid Earth having a contribution to the global temperature, there is a very small amount of heat that actually comes from the subsurface, from the center of the Earth up to the surface, what we call the geothermal heat flux. It's just a tiny fraction of a watt per meter squared, which is a measure of the flux of energy. In contrast, the sun puts out about 1,380 watts per meter squared down towards the surface of the Earth, several orders of magnitude more energy. And so the surface temperature of the Earth is actually governed by the balance between that very large amount of heat coming in from the sun and the amount that's escaping off to space. And what greenhouse gas increased greenhouse gas concentrations tend to do is to redistribute that heat as it tries to escape out to space in such a way that the surface warms.
Let me go first to the phones, and maybe she'll help me answer my question. Beth in Memphis. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you.
Hi there.
My question is about the public knowledge and understanding of global warming and sort of the deficit between what the public is concerned about and what the scientific community seems seems to know. And I think that there are minorities of us here in the United States, especially, who are concerned about global warming and about climate change. But it seems like, as Americans tend to do, we don't get too upset about things and don't begin to act about things until we think, hey, you know, what is it that's going to be harmful to me about this, and why should I care? And I'm wondering where the education component is, as a science teacher myself, where the education component is between the scientific community and the general public to help us understand why it is we should be so concerned about these obvious problems and the implications that they're going to have for us for years to come.
Let me ask both Michael and Elizabeth, where does a science teacher who believes in the science, with this tremendous disinformation campaign that's been going on about global warming, where can she go to, you know, to get the facts? Let me ask Dr. Mann first.
Well, there are a number of excellent sources out there that describe the science that underlies climate and climate change and global warming. A number of government agencies provide excellent informational sites, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and other government agencies as well.
You mentioned your own site before.
Well, that's right. A number of my colleagues and I felt that there was a need for an outlet through which actual scientists who work on the science could cut directly through much of the confusion and the disinformation that exists in the public discourse on the topic. And so we founded this website, realclimate.org, as a means of communicating what the actual science has to say. Mm-hmm. And with realclimate.org, we're attempting really to be what I would call an honest broker in the climate change debate. We try to cut through the disinformation and the distortion and focus on the science.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Beth, it's a good spot for you. You're welcome. We're talking about global warming this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Elizabeth, do you want to jump in with any?
No, I think that Beth made a very good point, though, that we really need, as a country and many other countries, have had much more public education on this topic.
Is that one of the reasons why The New Yorker decided to tackle something like this and a multi-part series that you're doing?
Well, I think that The New Yorker decided to tackle it because it is such an important issue. I mean, perhaps the most important issue of our time. And I guess that sort of speaks for itself.
That's a very strong statement to say perhaps the most important issue of our time.
It is a strong statement. I guess I'd stand by it, and I think many other scientists would stand by it. What we're doing now, I think that the thing that's important to keep in mind, and Dr. Mann mentioned it before, is what we're doing has implications for hundreds of years. And so it's not something that can be reversed. So we are making decisions without even realizing it, without even knowing and without even thinking. We're making decisions that will really affect the future of the planet for several generations at the least.
Mm-hmm. And it will impact our economy, our health, all different, every kind of.
Absolutely. When you start to think about, you know, how we're dependent on the climate, and it's sort of a useful exercise to go through, it's everything from, you know, your drinking water to what you eat and to what diseases you get. And so it's pretty much every aspect of life has some climatic component.
So you would think that when someone, or the president or someone else, talks about national security issues, this would be at the top of the agenda if you believe in that, you know, global warming, which the president is not convinced of publicly.
Well, that's where we get into a lot of complexity, and one area you could argue why we haven't had a particularly good public education campaign is because in Washington people are still, you know, wrangling about, you know, whether they believe it or not. And in my view, we really need to get past that. We really need to talk, as Dr. Mann said, about the real science and move on and decide, you know, what, if anything, we want to do, but stop wrangling about, you know, whether it's real or not, because it's real.
Dr. Mann, any thoughts on it?
Well, I think that's right. I think the role of those of us who work in the science of climate and climate change, I think our role is to provide the best available science that we can to the policymakers, not to get involved in the policy debate, but to leave that to others, but to make sure that that debate is in fact informed by a correct understanding of what the science has to say.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to understand what the downside of believing in global warming. What could be the downside?
Well, there's a tremendous downside for certain segments of the economy. I think there's a reasonable argument to make there's a tremendous upside potentially for certain segments of the society. But those segments that feel that they are, you know, the coal industry or whatever, just to single them out, they feel that if we start, you know, limiting emissions, it's going to have an impact on them. And that's where you're seeing a lot of the lobbying efforts coming from.
All right, we're going to have to let it go and obviously take this up as we go along. Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker in New York City. Michael Mann, professor in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Thank you both for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to continue with our Earth Day theme today and talk about how to make your Prius even better. Didn't think you could do that. Well, stay with us. We'll tell you how. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.